Hey, what's up, Hepcats and cool customers? It is Paisley Garcia, the flower child, here for Vice 1960s. Pull up a rainbow and open your third eyes, because we're letting our freak flags fly in Vietnam. First, we hang out with a jam band. They call themselves the Catholic Freedom Fighters Indochina Phalanges Corps, and we learn to make spring rolls with them. It's a totally far-out experience. And we grok their wave of spiritualism and thinking outside your own head. Back stateside, we have a drum circle and a poetry reading with the National Student Association, who tells us how they managed to keep the flower family in Vietnam together with a letter-writing campaign and sponsored freakouts in the jungle they call training camps. Because the vibrations of Vietnam, they are swiftly becoming bogus. It's not all rocking out and smoke and dope. And the Viet Cong have been bogarting the north of the country, harshing mellows from Saigon to Hanoi with their square conformity. Finally, we'll be going to Monaco for a love-in with Emperor Bao Dai on his yacht, and we'll definitely feel the power of love there, because we'll be going in for a vibration session, reaching out to Ho Chi Minh through the cosmos, sending our flower power his way so he'll realize he can put down the gun, pick up a daisy, and just be, man. But before this crazy train gets a rollin', I want to take a moment to acknowledge our corporate sponsor, Permindex, who forked out the dough for this jazzy jam session.
What kind of person to say a toto-so? You know what? A toto-so. A fucking a toto-so.
Hey, welcome back to this episode of The Bottleman, the Canadian politics podcast with a name that is not relevant to anyone who has not seen Trailer Park Boys and heard Dan and my conversation about how we wanted our name to relate to Trailer Park Boys.
That's right.
It is Dan and Riley, and we are here with part two of our exploration of Vice Magazine, asking this time, what, if anything, are the politics and potentially foreign policy of Vice Magazine? We're very excited to be joined by Chapo Trap House's Felix Biederman. Felix, how's it going?
Hey.
So, just before we sort of crack too far on, I wanted to sort of just ask you guys directly, right? What is your earliest memory of Vice having, like, politics, right? Of it not just being like fashion do's and don'ts.
I would say like 2012, 2013, when they started sending like, you know, 95-pound men to Ukraine. And it's like, I didn't used to think that they had like a comprehensive political vision. Now I do think that. But like before, until like 2015, when I really started piecing all their like bullshit together, I was like, oh, they all just send like a cokehead from New York to like a place where guys have guns. And they're like, wow, which is like kind of what they do. And I think to like most people that watch them, that's just how they take it. But there is like sort of like a quasi anarchist interventionist ethos to Vice.
Yeah. And it's definitely like absorbed some of the nihilism of their early, Vice guides to travel, I think. I was thinking about this question a lot, and I remembered the first, maybe not the first time I was aware of Vice having politics, but the first time I was aware of them having an interest outside of like Metro Montreal and Metro New York was watching the Vice Guide to Travel on VBS on the Balkans. And I think it sums up like Felix, you're the sort of pre 2010, 2012. State Department Vice. So they're this is the description of the Balkans section. While most of us were hung up on grunge, the republics of the former Yugoslavia spent the early 90s hung up on seceding into their own countries and mass murdering people over infinitesimal ethnic differences.
Yeah, that's the same kind of thing, isn't it, as a music preference? Just flatten
that. Yeah, totally. But then the politics creeps in at the end here, but they say, you know, like, our first stop is a nostalgic amusement park in northern Serbia that recreates Marshal Tito's Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia with startling accuracy and grimness.
Oh, good. I'm glad that it had all of the grimness, all the trudging, definitely recreating some bread lines. It was great.
Well, that's a great writing.
Yes.
More than anything, that's amazing writing. The thing I've known Vice for.
Yeah, of course. So other guys to travel, they had the Vice Guide to Liberia was their big breakout one, where they sort of showed this, again, this, you know, tiny man from Brooklyn walking through Liberia, meeting General Butt Naked. They also hung out in a gun market in Karachi or all this. So and Shane Smith actually did an interview about this, right, where he said how this sort of kicked off all of their like international political interest. He said, well, we started expanding the magazine, and every country we went to, they had these crazy stories. We went to Bulgaria, where they were selling warheads in the black market, to Chernobyl, to Congo. I want to go to the Kingdom of Mustang, where like 100 is making meth for Chinese prisons. I want to go to Mongolia. It's apparently totally insane. There's this place in Russia that has sort of North Korean slave workers sent by the government for money and resources and stuff that I want to go see. And I want to go to Vladivostok while I'm there because they make this huge mountain out of garbage and just shove it into the sea. Which is just like so fucking nihilist, I think. Like that's what this strikes me as completely, is just the early Vice political view is just standing and gawping at a bunch of like at the craziest shit you can imagine, I suppose.
Yeah, no, it's just like, oh, it's like if the 90s and early 2000s were like someone should do something, Vice eventually got there. But before that, it was like not even someone should do something. It's like something's fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's a bunch of garbage here. What if we played like some sort of like unlicensed post rock? While a guy with like threaded eyebrows like looked at the sea.
Yeah, I gotta say I had a very strange experience with this era of Vice, particularly because before I started being able to travel internationally with, you know, touring with my bands, I would read these articles and I'm not gonna lie, like part of me would be like, this is cool. I think it's mostly because I was just fucking stuck in Canada, and it worked on me. These places seemed exciting and strange. But once I started actually touring, like late 2006, I went to Serbia for the first time with Handsome First, and the illusion of that style of reporting was just completely shattered.
Yeah, I had the same thing. I had like, I actually think this is probably going to be a common experience, but like, do you remember when like iPhones first sort of, when everyone first started having them?
Yeah.
Like 2010, 2009. Yeah, when I was in like community college, I had this like, you know, like fat 19-year-old anxiety of like, people are going to be looking to see what I read on my phone and it better be cool. And so I'd be like, oh, I remember someone talking about this, and it would be like, you know, We met the guys who are doing body mods in Kiev, and they're Nazis, and we don't know if they're cool or not. So I would, yeah, just fucking go to Vice, because it's like, oh, someone will think this is cool if they walk by me. This is one way I can get pussy. And I don't think that's ever worked, but...
No, there's a 0% chance of that working.
But yeah, I thought it was like generally like cool and like... Not like I didn't like love it, but I was like, they're probably generally right about things. But yeah, then when I started like knowing anything at all, I was like, these guys are fucking stupid. also, they're like not cool. Yeah. Also, they suck. Yeah.
Extremely not cool. And their opinions on things are, you know, go beyond even being not cool to just like weirdly corrosive and reactionary.
So, in fact, not to defend CNN and the New York Times, but this is actually a segment from a book written about sort of, you know, 2010s media, where a Vice executive, says that Vice knows how to speak to younger viewers, claiming CNN listens to us and we're a trusted brand for them. The executive further suggested that Vice's renegade style of coverage in Africa rivaled the New York Times. The documentary then cut to a scene of a Vice report in Liberia, where a camera panned a beach littered with human excrement. A second segment featured villagers talking about cannibalism while holding up human organs. Shane Smith told this other executive from the Times, you know, these are legitimate stories that the Times wouldn't be willing to cover because the Times just wanted to write about surfing. Carr responded, just a sec. We've had reporters going there to report on genocide after genocide, and just because you put on a fucking safari helmet and look at some poop doesn't give you the right to insult what we do.
That's, I mean, yeah, they've got him there. Like, yeah. That is...
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it is, like, probably the lowest level of reporting you can do. Like, did you guys ever see, this is, like, later period bias, but did you ever see the Chirac one?
Oh, yeah.
That was, like, that's, like, Birth of a Nation. Like, that shit's so evil. It just takes, like, that they found, like, the most annoying guy in Brooklyn, and they're like, can you do sort of like a colonial look at black people in Chicago? And they're like, yeah,
of course we can. Didn't they get
We have this guy from a local parish council who's also in the police union, so he should be able to show you around.
yeah. Well, that's interesting because I want to talk about the types of guys that this era of Vice spawned. You know, so I think you have those early Vice reporters who were like Felix, like you said, 95-pound guy going to Ukraine, you know, or maybe they were, or maybe in the early 2000 or 2008, they were going to Russia and covering like an underground rave or something. But then sometime around 2012, 2013, Vice started spawning this new type of guy. And it was really when they started moving towards like the radioactive core of the U.S. state and the Obama administration that these new types of guys started spawning. And one of the perfect examples of this type of guy is fucking Elliot Higgins of Bellingcat, you know?
John Foster Dullard.
Yeah, he is a... the most important thing about him to me is that he's a something awful goon.
Oh, cool.
That's the real fucking skull and bones of the internet is something awful. Like there, and I mean skull and bones because it's like, you know, there are good members and there are bad members.
Yeah.
Just like in Skull and Bones. Like there's Donald,
yeah.
Who's an evil member, and there's Elliot Higgins, who's good.
Yeah. That's right. But and everyone gets cummed in.
Yeah.
It's just like Skull and Bones.
Well, everyone thinks I was in Skull and Bones, but I was not. I was a Skull and Bones lurker. I never posted in Skull and Bones.
Yeah, you got to pay $5 to lurk and post on Skull and Bones.
I did pay the $10, but I just like it was because I wanted to read the Dan Quinn mega thread. But I like I like knew enough. Like I thought those guys were really funny, but I knew enough. Like I would have been like worked for Elizabeth Warren if I had posted in GBS.
That's right.
I was so close, dude.
Yeah, you would have. It would have seen you in like 2012 going to Syria, being like, "Yeah, we're meeting the metal band that's working with USAID to bring this song about democracy to Idlib or whatever."
Yeah, that's the other thing I love about Vice before they like became part of the deep state is that. Like all those documentaries is like, yeah, like you said, we went to Russia and saw a rave or like we saw a metal band in the Congo. And it's like, well, yeah, like these people like have culture. Like, of course, there's a fucking rave in Russia, you dumb fuck.
Yeah, we live in a fucking globalized world.
Yeah, like why wouldn't they? Like, do you think they live in a snow covered village and like heat pots under a big fire?
Yeah, no, it's all just an Amnesty International ad. It's all one of those 2-minute ads, and it's everyone's just sort of in misery all the time, just sort of staring into the middle distance, either trudging or covered in flies. No one actually does anything, and so it's this. Whoa, there are skateboarders in Afghanistan. It's like, yeah, it's pretty easy to make a skateboard. Like you can just do it.
Yeah, like. Just assuming every young Russian living in Moscow has like an Einstürzende Neubauten haircut and is into hair metal or whatever. Like, yeah, it's absurd.
Yeah.
When I was doing a little research on Elliot Higgins, I watched this episode of Vice's Super Users program. It's like, I think it's like a new vertical. I don't know. It's about guys who are good at the internet, basically. And I realized as I was watching it, I was like, Elliot Higgins is like the evil Michael Hudson.
Yeah.
Because he's a GeoGuessr guy, right? Like, that's his thing. That's how he got his start, was identifying munitions and being able to map photographs. He's also a guy identifier, you know? Like he identifies Russian guys, types of Russian guys.
That's right.
Whereas, like, Michael is, when he finds a guy, it's like, oh, this is like some guy who lives in a place in Louisiana that like isn't on any maps and like lost his arm because his truck ran over it and built one out of a tree that has full locomotion.
Yes. Yeah. Also, he is still wearing that Avengers flat brim, but also all that other stuff. The only real similarity, I guess, is just, the Avengers flat brim sort of on everyone. Just when Michael Hudson does it, it's for the when Elliot Higgins does it for the NED. Maybe the NED is funding Michael Hudson's Patreon.
That would be amazing.
I mean, he's very good at GeoGuessr, like the best player in the world, probably. They should give him money.
Yeah. It'd be better than giving fucking Elliot Higgins money.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, another type of guy that this era of Vice spawned, I think, is equally corrosive, is like the Justin Ling type of guy.
He rocks.
Yeah, like ex-Vice doofus, famous for defending Chrystia Freeland's Nazi collaborating grandfather during the 2017 Canadian Russiagate scandal. Like, and you know, in preparation for this, I had to dive back into Justin's work, and I was wondering, you know, like how did Justin become like this? How did he go from writing just like puff pieces for Vice to being like someone that the Globe and Mail asks about cybersecurity, right? And like I don't think anyone wakes up one day and decides they're going to write an article where the thesis is the Manchurian Candidate is a documentary. Like you have to be able to jingle the keys in front of your own eyes. You have to have a bit of a dog's brain, and you also have to believe some of the shit that you're writing about. You have to believe some of it's true. But the main thing you need is like a mix of just being totally credulous and completely incurious about the world around you or anything anyone is telling you, you know?
Yeah, well, it's like, but what you have to do is you have to be able to, know what you're supposed to say and then sort of talk down to anyone who says that, like, you're full of shit, basically. Like, you have to be incredibly arrogant as well, right? And that's just the liberal internationalist journalist brain, right? Where it's just like, where you have to, like, everything is of incredible importance. You know, our mortal enemies are like hacking all of our brains, like literally in the case of Justin's article. But like, and if you don't believe everything I'm saying, then either you're a stooge or you're too dumb to get it. And like, it comes up in all of their articles. But again, like, you know, that period of Vice where we get beyond like 2008, 2009, 2010 and get from like 2012 to 2018, like it's really quite like it's rife throughout. And I think, you know, like Higgins and Ling are just examples of that.
Yeah, they're byproducts of this. Mm. And like, you know, one major tell that something had really changed with Vice's approach to reporting on global conflict was just the sheer amount of times they were cited by the Broadcasting Board of Governors. Which is, you know, like for anyone listening and who doesn't know, it's an independent agency of the U.S. government that operated all of its state media outlets like Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, et cetera, et cetera. So the BBG website would list every citation from one of their various media arms. And back in the mid-2010s, Vice was just fucking topping the charts. And they've since changed their name to this benign, like, U.S. Agency for Global Media and stopped posting citations.
I wonder why they would stop. It's the same thing, right? Where you know what line you're supposed to take, whether or even if you're not like doing it cynically, you just know what the good line is because the government says what it is. And journalism is like taking that good line and then like packaging it around a video where you make a bong out of 10 everyday household objects, essentially. Like that's it. This is what edgy journalism for young people is now. We have to intervene in Syria. Here's how to make a bong out of like a soda can.
Did you ever listen to the interviews that Shane Smith did on Joe Rogan?
I haven't.
No.
That's like probably exactly when I started realizing that Vice sucked. Because it was in 2012, 2013, back when, like, most episodes of Joe Rogan used to be awesome. Because it was like, oh, here's a guy I know, and his only qualification is he's British, and he thinks that, like, the ancient Babylonians had spaceships. And it would just be, like, the dumbest shit you ever heard, but it was awesome to think about. Or, like, yeah, a guy who's like, I eat one meal a day, it's 7,000 calories, I can deadlift 780 pounds, and here's my new book, Gibbon Fitness, how to behave exactly like an ape.
Kind of closer to Coast to Coast.
Yeah, it was like before he would have like Ben Shapiro and people like that on, but he would have Shane Smith on, and there was one time where Shane Smith was super fucked up, and it was, you know, like a 4-hour podcast, and two of those hours were Shane Smith being like, you're the realest fucking guy I've ever met. But then at one point he went, you know, and it's crazy, like, America, Russia, and China have to, I've seen all this crazy shit, and we have to team up to stop Muslims. what, dude? Like, what kind of politics is that? Like, that's the only, and it's really funny to think of that now. With Vice's like current output, but it's like, what, man? I just realized that he's like a profoundly stupid person, and I was like, oh, this publication probably sucks.
Oh yeah,
their shit is also it was Twitter. Like when I started like actually talking to people who like lived in the Middle East, they were like, yeah, we fucking hate those guys. Like those guys suck.
Yeah. Same here. Once I started, you know, like becoming friends with Russians and Serbian people, you know, I was just like, this is not just cringy. It's like actually fucking awful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shitty.
Well, and the thing is, right, like there's a little bit I hear a section I have here called Shane Smith just loves important people. Felix, what do you? OK, just a quick up front here. If you could, what do you think of John Boehner, former Republican Speaker of the House, John Boehner, just quickly?
A weepy alcoholic austerity demon.
Okay, so here's what Shane Smith has to say about John Boehner. When you meet him, he's classic Washington. He tells great anecdotes. He's funny and he's charming. He sort of comes across as a non-psychopathic Frank Underwood. He believes...
Isn't that Frank Underwood's entire character?
Well, here's
God, he's so fucking stupid. He's like if Beetlejuice wasn't scary.
He believed...
What the fuck are you talking about, man?
He believed that he was in a good position to get legislation done because it had to have Republican and Democrat fingerprints on it. And when he talks, he sounds great.
Oh, God. This is like a busy town book where Huckle visits the Capitol.
Yes. Yeah.
It's essentially like Shane Smith's busy box where he gets to meet fancy men.
Oh, yeah, he is, like, ahead of his time there because it's, like, there has been a rehabilitation of John Boehner because he'll, like, he'll do epic things, like, you know, say that Ted Cruz is an asshole, but it's, like, no, he's, like, also, like, bad. Like, he's also, like, a piece of shit. Like,
well, wouldn't you know it, he was ousted from his party for being too bipartisan just for meeting with Obama, and I think that's a tragedy.
Oh, yeah.
It's a real fucking tragedy. John Boehner has to be like a legalized weed guy now.
Yeah, like richer than he'll ever need to be, just like happily wine drunk every day of the week. What a tragedy for John Boehner.
After meeting him, you think we want more people like this in politics, and in what we're getting instead is demagogues and populists. Thank you, Shane Smith. I'm so glad you had fun meeting John Boehner.
Yeah, John Boehner, by the way, like, helped completely gut the social safety net throughout his entire career.
Yep. At least he wasn't a demagogue or a populist. He wasn't a demagogue or a populist. And most importantly, he sat down and talked to Shane Smith. You know who else is another important person that Shane Smith met was MBS.
Yes. Ooh, what does he have to say about him?
Recently too.
Yeah, in 2017, Prince Khalid, MBS's little brother and a big fan of Vice's edgy approach to the news.
That's a great sign.
Yo, I love they make the news fun. initiated a meeting between MBS and Smith on a yacht, believing that Smith could speak to young Saudis more attracted to online platforms. So what came of it was that the Saudi Research and Marketing Group, I don't know if it came of this meeting or another meeting, but like eventually Vice then worked with them. And Vice.
Sorry, a little background on that firm. That was started by Prince Turki Al-Faisal, who was a Saudi ambassador to the UK and probably the single most important figure in creating the Taliban, like from Saudi Arabia's end, like the single, like he was the link between America, the ISI and elements in Afghanistan. He was like the contact man between bin Laden and everyone else. He was like, and yeah, Saudi media and marketing, that's his baby.
So they partnered with Vice on a series of promo videos about Saudi Arabia. The first video about an elite camel race in the desert has millions of views on YouTube, but I actually copied the description for one that I thought was really funny, which is actually from Vice News Shorts for a video called How Muslim Pilgrimages Could Diversify the Saudi Economy. The description goes, Saudi Arabia is weaning itself off from oil dependency, and religious pilgrimages are a big part of the plan. The revenue that Saudi Arabia generates from oil could be replaced by tourism. After all, Mecca is Saudi Arabia's most visited city because of its religious significance. From transportation projects to real estate deals with commercial chains, the face of Mecca and other holy cities is changing at a rapid pace that many locals are not prepared for. But by improving services and infrastructure available to pilgrims, Saudi Arabia hopes to embrace the change and double its number of annual visitors. I love journalism.
I love journalism, too.
Journalism is so cool.
Yeah, this is like an internal trade publication for Disney World.
Yeah. This is an announcement that there's a new ride opening.
Yeah.
Like, not even meant for the public to consume. This is just to, like, get the guy in the Mickey costume to know where to point.
Well, this is probably how Shane forgot his idea to have Russia, China, and America team up to stop Islam.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, because he was like, well, wait, are you saying a Muslim guy's got a big boat?
Well, yeah.
I got them all wrong.
Completely changed his course on the matter. Yeah.
That's rules. So the other way that sort of Vice loves important, or Shane Smith loves important people, is that for a few years, Vice essentially became an Obama policy surrogate. So just in the back of your mind, remember this name, Alyssa Mastromonaco, where she was initially on the same team in Barack Obama's office that included such comedy heavyweights as Jon Favreau, Tommy Vietor, etc. So she could have. She actually has a show on Crooked Media, but in 2015 she joined Vice Media as COO. So I just for fun, I've grabbed four article titles about their coverage of Libya. 2012, celebrating Gaddafi's death with a Libyan on a Segway. Cool journalism.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So cool.
2013, hanging out in Benghazi's makeshift arms market. 2014, Libya, a broken state.
What could have possibly happened?
2015, experts say Libya's oil holds the key to the Islamic State establishing control of the country and turning it into a base for future attacks on Europe.
Yeah, no, that's the full range. It's like, yeah, no, it's epic. We're doing a revolution to be afraid all the fucking time and bomb this country again, but for a different reason.
Yeah. We bombed it once, and it's created a bunch of problems that, whiz-bang, wouldn't you know it, we had to bomb it again. By the way, if you look at what we were writing about it 4 years ago, we were talking about how we were, like, riding a Segway in Tripoli.
Yeah, it's a pretty stark shift in tone.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, I'm not necessarily saying, like, oh, yeah, Mastromonaco joined, and they became Obama, and she said, we're going to be an Obama shop now, right? I'm not saying that. Rather, what I'm saying is, like, it's just... As it became more, one of the ways, right, that we've talked about this on sort of our episode with Davide Mastracci, actually, which is that one of the, when an outlet wants to feel serious, they hire politicians and advocate for bombings. That's why every Canadian major masthead has advocated that Canada get involved in every war at every opportunity, even once we didn't go to Iraq, but every newspaper wanted us to go there. Every single fucking newspaper. And it's the same thing here. When you want to get taken seriously as a media organization and you're run by people with fucking dog brains, then you're just like, well, what do serious places do? They warn about the dangers of not bombing places and make the difficult but necessary decision that we have to go continue just pushing this blood-soaked empire across the rest of the world that doesn't want us there. And that's how you be a serious magazine, which is very depressing. But also, they do have some levity because who they hired to be their lead on Vice TV was none other than funny man Bill Maher. So he produced the whole show and a few episode titles of examples from there. Dawn of a Dictator aired 2017. Two vice crews report from Venezuela, which is crumbling following an economic crisis caused by socialist policies. Which is very objective, you know, certainly not loading the premises there.
They should deploy Bill Maher there to take down Maduro.
On the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah, with satire.
Yeah.
With dry jokes.
Yeah. Finally, a new rule for Venezuela.
Bill Maher should pay Maduro's day rate and fuck him.
That's right. So, Iran and Iraq. Isabel Young travels to Iraq to see how Iran is exerting its growing influence over the war-torn country ahead of parliamentary elections. That's May 8th, 11th, 2018. And another one, the war at home in Putin's Crimea. Isabel Young investigates how Crimeans are faring under Russian control and how Ukrainians are still clinging to the hope of reunification. I wonder who those Ukrainians are.
Yeah, which Ukrainians? I wonder if they're Ukrainians that live in the west of the country, in a small sliver of the west of the country.
Yeah, it couldn't possibly be them.
I wonder if they're Ukrainians whose grandfathers fought with the Wehrmacht.
Yeah, well, I wonder if it's Ukrainians who now have relatives in the highest echelons of Canadian government. Anyway, so, but that's just like a sampling, right, of their... of the approach they would take to sort of covering sort of these foreign policy issues. And again, it's not universal because one of the things about Vice is it's this enormous colossus of just commissioning articles for like, you know, free or $50 or however much like what they pay for a freelancer and then just pushing it out. And so like some people like in 2015, there were people saying, hey, maybe we shouldn't intervene and stuff. But if you look at the overall thrust of like what they're willing to be critical of, if you look at what they program on the TV, especially the TV is the part that remained most reactionary for whatever reason, probably because of Bill Maher's involvement. You certainly see there appears to be an editorial tilt in favor of sort of liberal interventionism, etc. And Shane Smith has said as much, right? He's a centrist. He believes in this kind of thing personally when interviewed. But nothing. If that is slightly mixed, then their coverage of Obama was certainly not. Because even though it took a bit of a harsher turn after 2018, during his presidency up until and including the very end, you'd be hard-pressed to find much unhedged criticism. For example, in the weeks leading up to the election, one of the articles they released was a definitive ranking of U.S. presidents from lamest to coolest. The lamest...
Who was on top of that?
Well, the lamest was John Tyler, 1841 to 1845. Because of, I guess, like slave ownership. The coolest, surprisingly, was Barack Obama. So, whoa. Saying, Barack Obama is the coolest president. It's not even close. Obviously, being the first black president is cool, but there's much beyond that. He spent his formative years in Hawaii. He hung out with a group of pot smokers called the Choom Gang. I always love being
very cool.
I love being reminded of the Choom Gang. This guy doesn't just have sex, he fucks. Compare him to the video of our next president awkwardly dancing on Ellen. Yeah, so how did that happen? How did that work out? You can...
I forgot. I was like, wait, did Trump dance on Ellen?
Yeah, I had the same reaction to that as well. I was like, wait, did he dance on Ellen? Was that in his, like, Fallon days?
They should have done that. They should do that now. Because, like, people are mad at Ellen. But it would be like a great, that would bring the country together because Ellen's sort of like the liberal Trump because she's also a bad person. But yes. People make excuses for her. they're like, she's like, Ellen's crimes are like being mean to Ellen staffers, I think, which is like, you know, neither good nor bad. I don't really know where to put that. But I think, like, because, like, everyone who likes Trump thinks Ellen has been executed or is, like, on house arrest, right? But I think that could be, like, a great collaboration thing if they do a lighthearted interview.
That's right. It goes on. Yeah, you should be upset with his failure about to close Guantanamo and drone strikes and lots of other things. But come on, he's a cool guy. And that's kind of like, if I wanted to summarize the coverage of Obama, that basically would be it. There is, again, some criticism that's saying, yes, he is a neocon president. In fact, I reproduce this. It says, yes, he is a neocon president, which makes him no different from every other post-Cold War president. This is from 2015. But the article ends with the line, that's one reason the U.S. is fairly evangelical about spreading its political mores and values around the world. And this is a part of what's fueling the broader conflict between the U.S. and groups like Al-Qaeda. Western democracies and violent Islamists are carrying out a blood-soaked negotiation about whether true democracy or true Islam can coexist. So even in, like, the non-interventionist articles, it ends with, like, yeah, well, you know, basically it's just going to be a fight between the West and Islam, so we'll see who wins. Yeah. it's bad, but, you know, hey, I guess that's why we're doing it, which is awesome. But I think the funniest thing, I think, was, Felix, do you remember when Shane Smith it kind of went on a tour of a prison with Obama and forgot he wasn't his press secretary?
Yes. Yeah, that was a great Shane video product.
That was one of my favorite Shane vids. So basically, I actually watched the entirety of that interview and transcribed bits I thought we'd like to talk about today. So Shane Smith asks, this is the first time in history a sitting president has visited a federal prison. Why now and why today? Obama says, over the last 20 years, we've seen a shift in incarceration rates that's really unprecedented, doubling the prison population, a large percentage of which is for nonviolent offenders. To which Shane Smith then asks this penetrating follow-up question, but how did this happen? Yeah. Again, not. So, what do you do about it? No. So, how did this happen? Do you have a talking point you might like to share, Mr. President, in this historic interview? So that's the first line. Here's the next line that I thought was quite interesting. Smith says, 1 in 17 white men will go to jail, whereas 1 in 3 black men will go to jail. Is the criminal justice system in America racist? Obama then replies, I think the criminal justice system interacts with his society in a way that results in injustice and unfairness. And the rest of the answer is an extremely hedged avoiding saying yes or no, basically. Shane Smith's follow-up is one of the reasons you're here today because you're the first president to feel empathy for the people who are here?
What a great question. I also love, yeah, Obama did his best, like, Obama answers in here where he's like, there are many societies in the world. Ask him a very simple yes or no question.
Yeah. And it's just like, yeah, he's going to say an answer that's kind of like sounds like a yes to people who want him to say yes, but who where, you know, it's too complicated for anyone who wants him to say no to really hear it, or they don't care. And so it's like hedged to shit. And it's the president talking about like, these like the injustice of the criminal justice system. And the follow-up question is, do you think you're the most empathetic president? and then this is where Smith forgets he's not his press secretary and says, the president didn't just want to talk about the problem, though. He wanted to speak directly to the people who were doing time as a result of it. So he asked to sit down with 6 inmates for an unprecedented and unfiltered conversation. Which, again, Shane Smith then just sits beside him for while Obama has, again, like what feels like a very stage managed conversation with 6 guys who are like, well, I regret all my wrongdoings and I just want to make it right with society. And Shane Smith just sits there. It's like a Labrador nodding along, which is cool. So the last piece of this interview I have is towards the end. Shane Smith asks, can this ever be fixed? Obama, most people don't see the impact the criminal justice system is having in our communities. Part of our job is to shine a spotlight on that.
What?
As the president, I'm gonna.
Yeah, the president is the head spotlight shiner.
Yeah. Well, it's like the most important thing you can do politically is raise awareness, and the president's amazing at raising awareness. And so, if we just raise enough awareness, then there will be like a kind of spontaneous outburst of morality. among like the general electorate who will then, I don't know, like vote Democrat. Like I remember like at this time, like Obama wouldn't have been able to like do much about it because he didn't like have the House or the Senate. Like he would have been able to do like executive orders, but like he could, like, he pardoned a record amount of people when he left office, but like that was still like 1300. Like that's what, like one, that's like less than 1% of America's prison population, like a third of a percent. Like he has the power to do stuff. He just didn't do it. And at no point, it's like Smith kind of like took it almost for granted, that whole narrative that like, ah, well, Obama wants to do stuff to fix the country, but he can't because of the Republicans or because of strategy or because of 12D chess or whatever. And it just is an opportunity for him to give a bunch of speeches and perhaps like one of the most insultingly, like it feels like an end zone dance. I don't know, just like I'm going to go to a prison and talk about why I can't fix it, even though I kind of can. So I'll throw back to you guys, right? Like what's the in terms of how do you fit this in with like the overall vice politics?
I think this is definitely just Shane clout chasing. I think there's no real politics involved here. It's submission to power via clout chasing.
Yeah, no, it's just like Shane impressed with himself that he gets to go to Obama with some place and just sort of like if you could put it anywhere in the vice political valence, it would just be there are problems in the world.
Yeah, look at yeah. These problems. They're hard. And like Obama ends up kind of falling in with that, which is like the Democratic sort of political strategy of politics as awareness raising is, yeah, just saying, hey, there are problems in the world. You should think about them and feel bad about them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this strikes me as one of the many, like, sort of for Democrat branded media products that's like, this is something you told people you watched.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. There was zero value in actually watching it. Yeah. Nothing of importance was said.
Yeah, you absolutely cannot. There's. What policy would you walk away recommending after watching this?
Vote Democrat.
Yeah, vote exactly. Democrat. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Or pat yourself on the back for voting Democrat.
Yeah.
Because they're shining a light on a big problem.
That's right.
You know what's like legitimately a good documentary Vice could do? Not because they'd be good at it, but just like they have a lot of resources. If they did something about like the Russians who own Sables.
Oh yeah,
and like raccoons and stuff, because that is a unique Russian cultural thing, and it would have to be like totally apolitical, because they would try to fit in some weird politics thing. But if you were just like, oh, like why culturally do Russians, you know, like think someone told me that like when people call animal control on raccoons in Russia, like people get mad because they're like, that's a perfectly good raccoon that could be a pet. And that would be a cool documentary.
I agree with that.
I do. Absolutely. Too. They're I like. Yeah. No. The way that they adopt mustelids is awesome, and I would love to see an English language documentary about it. But instead, you know, it's just going to be Nalvaney Doc number 40.
Yeah, we found this guy whose body is 95% plaid shirt, and we sent him to go check out the Russian sable farms.
Yeah. I got a lot of people in my life who claim to be, I'm an expert in animals because I have family members who are veterinarians, whatever, who are constantly telling me not to get a baby raccoon or three and make adorable videos with them. And it pisses me off.
Well, I'm very close to getting a skunk. I don't think I'll do it, but like they're fucking sick. Like you really shouldn't have a sable as a pet unless you rescue it from a fur farm and it like loses its fear of people and sort of has to live with people and you're really prepared, because owning a sable would be all the sables I follow, they'll do things like steal apples and put it on top of a dresser and let it rot for 3 weeks while you eat. Like they're like, you know, not supposed to live in houses or apartments, but like apparently skunks are like more chill with people.
Yeah, very friendly and intelligent.
Well, Vice, free documentary idea. Become the Skunk Network. Make documentaries about people who adopted skunks.
That would be such a better documentary than like, oh, we met a Russian rapper. Like, yeah, of course there's fucking rap in other countries. You know what isn't in other countries is like tons of people who own raccoons.
It's going to be like, we're here with Oleg Brzezinski in Donbass, and we're going to be the Russian intelligence, or the Ukrainian Azov's intelligence raccoon division.
Yeah.
these sables have been funded by a strategic grant from USAID to spell.
It's fine. They only bite ethnic Russians. They can smell people who are loyal to the Putin regime.
That's all I have on Obama, though. So speaking of Russia, Dan, I believe you want to take it away.
Yeah, I want to talk about two documentaries that Vice made about 1 year apart from each other. One of them is bad, and the other one is just blatant propaganda and absolutely terrible. The first one is Vice Presents Cold War 2.0, which is made during the Bill Maher era. It seems to really be like Shane Smith's baby. The second one is called Vice, A World in Disarray, and was co-produced by Bill Haas, who is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, and came out in 2017. But so to give Vice credit, like the Cold War 2.0 one starts pretty strong. It paints a picture of like a post-Soviet world order where Russia has been backed into a geopolitical corner. Shane remembers his childhood and brings up the specter of mutually assured destruction. There's a hilarious part where he interviews Sergei Lavrov, who you can tell Lavrov just thinks he's a fucking toad man, thinks Shane Smith is just like a gremlin, and is just barely tolerating his presence.
I love stuff like that, where it's like someone from like Russia or China, somewhere where it's like definitely more of like a cutthroat political world, in which like not really a value judgment on either of those countries, but more like, I think everyone would recognize they all have very like cutthroat, difficult to navigate political arenas.
Yes.
And when a guy who gets to the top of that, like Lavrov, talks to like, yeah, a guy like Shane Smith, just like one of the dumbest North Americans, is so fun. I love shit like that, where it's just like, yeah, no, I grew up in a very uncertain world. I've seen my country go through all these like calamitous, almost apocalyptic stages. I've done things and seen things I never thought I would, and here I am sort of at the top. And then it just like meeting a guy whose fly has been down the entire trip.
Exactly. Who's asking you questions like, now you're not really going to invade Estonia, are you?
Yeah, exactly.
You
know?
You just have to tolerate that. Like, that time has been stolen from you, Sergei Lavrov, forever. You'll never get it back.
Yeah, you're just the dumbest fucking questions you've ever heard in your life. Is Russia going to legalize weed soon? Hey, what, man?
Yeah, have you heard this metal band in Vladivostok? They play on the pile of garbage. It's pretty sweet. Yeah.
Why are you putting Russian drill artists in jail? So this documentary, it does set up a compelling case for Russia being sort of attacked on all sides, which I gotta give Shane credit for that. But then it all totally falls apart. The conclusions that the documentary draws are totally at odds with everything the viewer has just seen, you know? So, and in trying to present the why part of Russia's perceived aggression of the West, they just totally leave out the whole part about America tanking Russia's economy in the early 1990s. They don't mention the Gaidar reforms.
Bill Browder was just there to help.
Bill Browder makes me angrier than anyone. Mm. I fucking hate, why? Oh, I wonder why Russia is fucked up. Why do you have $1 billion, you fucking piece of shit?
Yeah.
What a fucking scumbag.
And what's really galling, right, is that like the anti-corruption or like state corruption, like laws about like sanctioning foreign public officials or whatever, are named after this guy who's like, oh yeah, you're giving away all of that like worker funded USSR infrastructure. I'll just take that. I'll have that. And by the way, if you try to if you navigating what is, if you real politic terms, kind of a battlefield of a country again, because we kind of did that. By the way, it's if you try to stop me, I'm gonna name the law after my heroic quest to enrich myself at your expense. It's cool.
Yeah. No, I would. If we could have. If this is what it took for a reset in American-Russian relations, I would give them Bill Broder happily. I would give him. I would give them Bill Broder for nothing. What are we talking about?
Right.
Yeah.
Take
absolutely.
Him. I don't give a fuck about this guy.
Nope. That's right.
I want to just highlight some incredible moments from this documentary. One of them being a very surprisingly coherent Joe Biden, so coherent I didn't recognize him when he first popped on screen. But Shane interviews Joe Biden, and Joe Biden says, imagine Putin says, where there are Russian speakers, I have an obligation as a Russian leader to protect them. Like, doing the Hitler comparison and then just kind of leaving it hanging, right?
Yeah.
Another really great moment is Simon Ostrovsky, who was one of their main, if not their main, Ukraine correspondent. He did a 78-part series on post-Maidan conflict in eastern Ukraine. So he's interviewing the Lithuanian president at the time, Dalia Grybauskaitė, who says this. She says, in 1940, we did a mistake. We didn't fight back to the Russian invasions, and because of that, we stayed in the Soviet Union for over 40 years. And if you think that at this point the documentary tries to contextualize the shit that she's saying, you'd be totally wrong. Because what it does is cut to a bunch of Estonians training with NATO troops on the Russian border.
Again, could be a trenchant criticism of NATO if it was just framed a little bit differently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So and the question to ask, obviously, is what was happening in 1940? Why were the Soviets invading? Who was in charge of Lithuania?
The proto-EU.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. Again, the whole thing, right? Of just it's where it seems like, yeah, we're just not. We kind of know what the line is. And again, it doesn't even necessarily have to be cynical. It's like, no, this is what you believe if you're a liberal or whatever. It's like, it's that Russia bad. History started in 1990. And, NATO, and if you want to know what NATO actually does, why research them at all? It's just on their website.
Yeah, and the Forrest Brothers Wehrmacht division were actually on the side of a united Europe.
By implication, I suppose.
But yeah, so, there's this documentary, and then there's an abrupt tone shift with the Council on Foreign Relations produced documentary called World in Disarray. Council on Foreign Relations basically established as a capitalist realpolitik pivot away from the anti-communist rhetoric in America as a sort of reason for intervention. But I'm just going to read you guys the cast of characters in this CFR produced documentary. Condoleezza Rice, Francis Fukuyama, Blinken, Samantha Power, Strope Talbot of the Brookings Institute, Tony Blair, Miliband, and Thomas Hendrik Ilves, the very nationalist at the time Prime Minister of Estonia. And all of these people and what they're talking about are centered around criticizing the Obama administration for not going far enough with intervention and arming rebels in Syria and Ukraine and kind of North Korea too. They get into North Korea in a very, very bizarre hawkish
way. Who the fuck could they arm in North Korea?
Yeah, no, I mean, this is an aside, but this is why I've been really saying keep your eyes on Blinken, because A, he is no significant policy departure from Pompeo, and B, he's the most dangerous ideologue in that entire administration.
I totally agree. I don't know if you saw Felix the other day. He was tweeting out about Russia shutting down Radio Free Liberty and Radio Free Europe in Russia. And he described it as, what did he say? He said it was a important source of independent journalism.
Yeah, amazing, amazing.
Like, not even Pompeo would have gone that far. Like, would have lied that blatantly, you know?
Yeah, that's the only significant difference between him and Pompeo is that Pompeo is, like, at least more honest in his vision of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, that it's, again, but, like, it's, he's not cool, you know? Or he's
right,
not like
right. Mike Pompeo would never be on Vice.
Yeah, it's not cool to know Mike Pompeo. He has no style, right? Like, it's why I think, like, it's a mistake actually to say that MSNBC and Fox or whatever are the mirror image Democrat Republican news organizations. It's kind of Vice now, or at least in this period, was that mirror image Democrat organization, because like. A lot of the stuff they said was like, you know, like again, after like Trump was elected, they were like, what we know so far about Russiagate or whatever. Like, they were on that story. They're talking to like CFR people and Blinken and all this shit. And like, but also they're prestigious. They're socially prestigious. They're cool. They're young. They've got that fucking Buttigieg thing, right? Where it's not just that they're, you know, for your, you know, aging parents, but it feels like being talked down to almost by, you know, like fucking, I don't know, Kamala Harris sitting on a chair backwards. But to remind yourself that it's all run by this Canadian oaf is somewhat insulting. <Yes.
laughs> Who just wants to talk to important people.
Yeah,
I think that's almost like the most fucked up thing about Vice is like throughout all this, we've identified definitely like a series of Vice political agendas. But like at the very top, it's just like, I mean, he's a mirror image of Joe Biden. He likes shaking people's hands.
Yeah, it's just a guy who has never closed his mouth. who's like just gone from key jingling to key jingling just in his wake, left a lot of consent manufacturing. I mean, so I guess we could sort of ask, right? Like, so there, it's sort of a lot of this stuff in Ukraine, right? And again, like, it has gone, it's not all the coverage has been like this, right? Like, they have done some of that reporting has been pretty balanced. But like a lot of the top line stuff that comes out of it is just like, oh yeah, Russians accidentally invented another Hitler, and so we have to arm basically everyone in Ukraine. We have to send over small arms to, you know, anyone we can find. Just airdrop guns over it, put bombs there, mine it, whatever. Just send whatever over there, because we have to, you know, we're not going to win if we're not playing, and the only way to play is to, you know, arm every side of the conflict. And God, it's just, and so it's sort of been doing that, right? But I think the question is, you know, what is it now? You know, that I'm less sure of, because it seems like it's less sort of directly in Obama world now, or less sort of suck up to Obama world. Vice TV is still kind of doing its own thing. You know, it's still kind of like this. The different verticals, right, are super different from one another as well, right? Like Motherboard. Yeah. Their technology vertical, I'd say, is basically like, I don't know, roughly aligned. Pro-union. Yeah, super pro-union, super like skeptical of AI kind of thing.
I like dated someone who like worked pretty high up at one vertical, and it was just like a normal like type of vertical for what it's like. But it was just like the common thread throughout all of it is that everyone hated working for Vice. I'm on like everyone she knew across every other vertical, but I'm on the Vice front page right now. The A1 story, the fall of the base nectar empire.
There we go.
And it's about the Me Too-ing of base nectar.
Well, hey, maybe Shane Smith got to be friends with like, and he got enough clout. He got to be friends with enough important people, and now Vice is going back to what it was in 2007.
All right. Well, I mean, maybe that kind of makes sense, because it's like Biden is about harkening back to a time before Obama even. Mm-hmm. That's like the unstated thing about Biden. It wasn't like people are like, oh, people just want to go back to Obama. It's like, no, they want to go before that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like they basically want the Bush years, but with a Democratic president.
Yeah.
Culturally, even though it's like very taboo to say that, that is like absolutely what I think like the majority of Americans want. And if you look at Vice right now, it is kind of like what a website I would read in 2007 would be like. Like, yeah, there is some stuff about like, oh, like, you know, the Proud Boys or whatever. But it's like mostly like, oh, here's a drug lord thing. Here's, yeah, base nectar. Here's, you know, here's like a sort of slice of life story from around the world. And I don't know, like, my outlook for most of ad revenue supportive media is very negative. I think there's going to be massive contractions even further in that industry. And I feel like for what the internet has become and for what hypermedia consumers have become subscriber based is the only model that has any longevity unless you, you know, own the market. Or are a market making force like only a few places are. But I do think that maybe they will find some purchase in this. If they can just, if they're like, they revert into sort of being like the same type of thing that like Grantland is, like, yeah, they'll probably be fine. They're still going to fire people because that's what media companies do. They always have to keep making more money. So you have to keep rolling three jobs into one and firing more people and furloughing more people. But yeah, they'll stick around for a bit longer.
Yeah. And it's interesting that the legacy from this era, right? Like the thing that they made in the lab that got out, even though maybe they're not doing this experiment anymore, the thing that got out is, to me, after reading all this stuff, is just the normalization of liberal interventionism. Like just like that got directly injected into mainstream media. You've got like, yeah, mutants like Justin Lang telling my dad to be afraid of Russia.
Yeah. And it's like, well, I'm also very curious to see where that goes, because like that, yeah, that became its own species and it went off in a lot of other places. But I have to wonder where it's going to go, because I like, there's always going to be a voice for interventionism in the North American and Western European media markets. And there's always going to be like some weird sliver of like Western liberals who are like, no, we have to invade X country this time.
Yes.
And, but I just don't, I think like intervention is with like people my age and definitely people younger is like broadly way less popular than it has been in my lifetime. And I think there is a way you can sell it to those people. I think it like looks like infographics and shit, but I don't think like the Justin Ling type people can do that. I don't think that's in their skill set. I think that's, you know, we're going to see the next crop of people, and the next crop of people, it might be like people who learned how to write and style things from like what Teen Vogue did. And then that's the next class of media interventionists.
Mm-hmm. Well, it goes from like the last class of media interventionist was almost like the sort of the cowboy reporter who's going in and getting the facts and sawing all this stuff, right? And
yeah,
but that was also a lot of cowboy type reporting. I'm the blogger. I'm following around Obama, right? You know, Joy Reid was a blogger before she was an MSNBC. That level of authenticity, right? So I wonder if it's going to be not authenticity next, but like the shared feeling of something.
I think that's going to be it, because like, look, what is Vice now? Vice is Teen, but like, if you look at the way that people talk about it and are like, oh, they're doing something new, even if it's not necessarily invented and just how it's packaged, that's Teen Vogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was in 2017. Like, how many fucking idiotic like posts from media reporters did you see where it's like, oh, Teen Vogue's covering the news? And it's like, yeah, they have an AP wire.
Yeah.
Like every fucking Condé Nast company has. But it's like, I mean, yeah, it's, they figured out that they could create some sort of like Condé Nast friendly like infographic Marxism. And the way that people have talked about them is very similar to how people talked about Vice when, you know, I was a kid. And I think that's the future. And I think you're going to see a lot of people who cut their teeth at Teen Vogue move on to other things. And I think those other things will be like most American journalism in concert with what people in center left halls of power want. And they'll figure out a way to try to sell interventionism that way. I still, I may be stupidly optimistic here, but I am sort of heartened by how universally unpopular interventionism is with millennials and Zoomers. But, you know, things change. Things do change, and you can sell all types of awful things to people.
Yeah.
For a million different reasons.
Yeah.
It's going to be a TikTok video infographics convincing you to parachute into Taiwan, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. I mean, we'll see. Like, I am very curious to see what happens with, like, all these sort of, like, you know, places that spawned out of Upworthy, what those people go on to do.
One thing I think we can know for certain is that it took a real magical quirk of history to make it so that the last, like, you know, like, intervention consent manufacturer, cool consent manufacturer, sort of was just spawned out of the desire of a Canadian guy to be taken seriously by important Americans.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, just like how, I mean, with Teen Vogue, it's just like some, like, disgusting 78-year-old was like in some boardroom at Condé Nast and was like, "My grandson told me that Marxism is hot." And then, like, you know, there's Teen Vogue.
"My brother Lou's got a gallery opening uptown. I gotta go."
Yeah. It's that guy invented, like, the new Teen Vogue. Yeah. It's just like, yeah, some guy who, like, looks like one of the prophets from Halo. Yeah. It's worked at Condé Nast since the Vietnam War.
It's Stan Perltzman. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but look, I'm noticing we are slightly running up to time, and I feel like that's put a nice bow on it. So I want to say, number one, Felix, thank you very much for coming on to the Bottleman today.
My pleasure.
Yeah. And to thank all of you for listening, and to remind you, $7 Canadian a month, second episode a week, Patreon, you know the deal. And to say, yeah, thank you for listening. Don't forget about all of that. And yeah, I think we will see you on the bonus episode on Thursday. Bye, everyone.
See ya.
Bye-bye.